Well, we're continuing in our study of Romans. Text today is Romans 12, verses 9 through 13. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. When I was at Asquith Church, Asquith was on Harford Road up in the northeast corner of Baltimore, kind of a major thoroughfare into the city. We used to get a lot of walk-in requests for assistance, and it often fell to me to determine, you know, what are we going to recommend to the deacons? Shall we help this person or not? And it was really, really difficult to determine which requests were sincere and genuine and which ones were lying through their teeth. There were several that it was perfectly clear they were lying. I probably related this story before. One fellow came in, said he was from Georgia, but he had been in the hospital and he needed money for bus fare to get back to Georgia. And he showed me his hospital bracelet, which you could see had been cut and taped back together. So he probably found it on the street somewhere, picked it up and used it to tell a lie. But it was difficult, because some people were sincere and were genuinely in need, while others were just looking for a quick handout and were not sincere at all. Paul tells us here in our text that our love must be sincere or without hypocrisy. Let's take a look at what he's saying here and see if we can get a better grasp on what he means. This idea of sincere love, this whole section is difficult with the syntax and the language. Literally, verse 9 begins, "the love unfeigned." That's all it says. There's no verb there. So it has to be supplied by the reader. And most English versions use the subjunctive, something like, "let love be sincere," or "let love be without hypocrisy." But it could just as easily be translated as the NIV does with the indicative, "love must be sincere." It can be rendered with the imperative, "love without hypocrisy." It could be a command. The New Living certainly captures the meaning, I believe, when it says, "don't pretend that you love others, really love them." That's a very loose kind of translation, but it captures the notion, I believe, that Paul is driving at. So this missing verb, then, in verse 9, is the lead verb for a long string of participles that follow. Now, again, our English versions most often translate those participles as imperatives, commanding us to do certain things, like be devoted, hate what is evil, cling to what is good, honor one another. They all come across as commands to us. But actually, they are all facets of this sincere love, explaining to us how we ought to love in this unhypocritical fashion. Now, often we turn to 1 Corinthians 13 when we're trying to define what love means, and appropriately so. And there we read, "love is patient, love is kind, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs, love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth, it always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres, love never fails." Now, these are attitudes or actions, and there's little to nothing here of what we often think in terms of romance or sentimentality. It's actually a description of hard work, things like self-denial and commitment when it's not an easy road. It's the same sort of thing we find here in Romans 12. The particular descriptions of love differ, but the idea is identical. So this true or sincere love does not come to us naturally. That which is natural is self-regard, looking out for good old number one. To sincerely devote ourselves to others is a commitment that we must make. But it is also something that God works in us by His Spirit. Now remember, too, that all of this is based, as Paul said at the beginning of chapter 12, all of this is based on the mercy of God that we've already received. This sincere love is a profound way, then, that we can renew our minds. not be conformed to the selfish way of the world that's all around us. So what are the aspects of this sincere love? And now we begin that long list of participles. Paul says, abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. Now, we're to have, according to what he says here, we are to have a horror in our hearts and minds for that which is evil. Now, we've largely been desensitized to a lot of evil around us. We're not gripped with horror when we see certain things anymore because we've seen all sorts of horrible things, whether by watching the news or some TV show or a movie or something like that, so that we're no longer shocked by the things that occur in this world. We remain unaffected by the horrors that are around us. If we are horrified, it's usually at something someone else does. We're rarely horrified by our own sin, which is what Paul is driving at here. We need to hate that which is evil. He doesn't say it, but I believe it's there in his mind. Hate that which is evil in me, in you. Here's a major deficiency in the church today. We've learned how to excuse our sin, to blame someone else, or to rationalize it away in one way or another. We need to be horrified by our attitudes and actions and flee from those things. Conversely, Paul tells us to be cemented to that which is good, honorable, or praiseworthy. It's reminiscent of what he said, we made reference to it a few weeks ago in Philippians 4:8. He tells us there to think of things that are good, things that are lovely, honorable, praiseworthy. We need to constantly fill our minds with good, with truth, or we will by nature be conformed to the world and our love will not be sincere. Then Paul tells us to be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Now there's a play on words here that that doesn't come out in the NIV statement. There's two words here. The word for brotherly love is one of them, and the word devoted is the other. They're both related to a Greek word for love. So Paul is sort of saying, love one another with love. The English versions render it differently. Let me read a few of them. ESV says, love one another with brotherly affection. New American Standard, be devoted to one another in brotherly love. New King James, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. New Living, love each other with genuine affection. So he's striving here to work in this sense of genuineness and the genuineness of the love involved with the idea of a constant commitment as well. Loving and keep on loving in this brotherly love sort of way. Paul continues, honor one another above yourselves. Literally here the word is lead or outdo one another in honor. We should be fumbling all over ourselves in trying to honor one another. Our natural bent is to seek honor for ourselves, but that's no longer appropriate since we are the redeemed of the Lord. All honor and glory should go to Him. Then, as a function of honoring God, we seek to honor others who are made in His image, who are redeemed by His blood. It connects directly with Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 13 that we mentioned before. True or sincere love is not self-seeking, as he says there. We cannot honor others or lead the way in honoring others if we're self-seeking. If we're always trying to get our own way, we're never going to be committed to the idea of honoring the other guy. Paul continues, never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Now, there's a good bit of diversity in the translation of this phrase in the English versions. The idea is don't be slothful or cool or lazy in your service to the Lord, but be hot in the Spirit, in a sense. Listen to how it's rendered. Here again, a number of English versions. King James, not slothful in business. NIV, never be lacking in zeal. The Old American Standard, in diligence, not slothful. ESV, do not be slothful in zeal. NAS, not lagging behind in diligence. New King James, not lagging in diligence. And NLT, never be lazy in your work. Now the term fervor here is literally the word to boil. We're to be hot for God and His agenda in that sense. We are not to allow ourselves to cool off relative to our stance for the gospel and for serving the Lord in all things. Zealously, we are to enslave ourselves to God. And that's pictured really well for us in this section from the Law of Moses. Listen to this. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he is to serve you for 6 years. But in the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. If he comes alone, he is to go free alone. If he has a wife when he comes, she is to go with him. If his master gives him a wife and she bears him sons and daughters, the woman and her children shall belong to her master, and only the man shall go free. But if the servant declares, I get this, I love my master and my wife and children and do not want to go free, then his master must take him before the judges. He shall take him to the door or the doorpost and pierce his ear with an awl. Then he will be his servant for life. That's a perfect description of what the Christian life is. We confess to God, I don't want to go free. I want to belong to you. He puts his seal on us and we belong to him for the rest of our lives. How dare we then allow our zeal to grow cold? It's our logical response to God for what He's already done for us in Christ. It makes good sense to serve and obey the God who redeemed us in the blood of Christ. Kids, let me talk to you. Have you ever gotten a certain toy or maybe a certain video game or something? You just want it. You want it so bad. And finally you get it. And it's like, this is great. And it's great for a few days or a week. Or maybe a month. But pretty soon it's like you never play with the toy anymore. You don't use that video game anymore. It just sits there on the shelf. What happened? Well, you were all excited about it at one point, but that excitement cooled off. Now that excitement, that's what the Bible is referring to with this word zeal. It's like, we're all hyped up. We want to do something. But in our faith in Christ, sometimes our zeal can get cold too. Just like you don't have interest in that game anymore, don't have interest in that toy. Maybe your interest in loving Jesus and following Him gets kind of cold too. Now, the reason that's bad is that God's zeal, God's excitement for us, never diminishes. He's always, if we can use the word, hot toward us because He loves us so much. So it really doesn't make any sense for us to let our zeal get cold. God always loves us with great intensity. What Paul is saying here in this passage, let's love Him in return like that, because He has so loved us already in Christ. Paul continues in his list. He says, be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. And we're to rejoice due to the hope that we have in Christ. Our hope is enormous. There's a whole life out there awaiting us, free from sin, free from alienation, free from disease and distress. And because of that hope, we can be patient with the afflictions and concerns of this present evil age, because there's a better life coming. But these concerns that we are involved in here and now are always a call to prayer. If you want to follow along, there's a quote here from Hodge's commentary in the blue sheet. You can follow along if you like. These exhortations refer to nearly related duties. Christians are to be joyful, patient, and prayerful, however adverse their circumstances. Hope, patience, and prayer are not only duties, but the richest sources of consolation and support. Rejoicing on account of hope, or in the most joyful expectation of future good, this hope of salvation is the most effectual means of producing patience under present afflictions. For if we feel that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us, it will be difficult to bear them patiently. Intercourse with God, however, is necessary to the exercise of this and all other virtues. And therefore, the apostle immediately adds, continuing instant in prayer. The original could hardly be better translated, as the Greek term expresses the idea of perseverance and ardor in the prosecution of any object. There are no attributes of accessible prayer more frequently presented in the Scriptures than those here referred to, as perseverance and fervor, which from their nature imply faith in the ability and willingness of God to grant us needed good. So the three are connected. The joy, the patience, the faithfulness in prayer. And, oh, that we would learn the beauty of that. So that many of those sufferings that we go through, we could face them with some level of joy because we've been faithful in prayer. And there are millions today who are suffering, who are doing this. Or the millions who have gone before us were patient in their afflictions. But with our prayerlessness and our focus so often on temporal things, is it any wonder that we're hopelessly impatient? Helen Lemmel was a vocal music teacher at Moody Bible Institute a generation or so ago. She expressed this notion quite well in the refrain of her well-known hymn, where she writes, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in His wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace." That's the idea. Joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Paul continues, "Share with God's people who are in need." Here the NLT expresses it, "When God's children are in need, be the one to help them out." There's no magic formula here. You see a need, you do something to help. Now we have a primary responsibility to look out for the needs of fellow believers. There's a story told of Spurgeon and his wife. They would sell, but they refused to give away the eggs that their chickens laid. Even close relatives were told, "You may have them if you pay for them." And as a result, some people labeled the Spurgeons as greedy and kind of grasping. And they accepted the criticisms without defending themselves. It was only after Mrs. Spurgeon died that the full story was revealed. All of the profits from the sale of eggs went to support two elderly widows that they knew. Because the Spurgeons were unwilling to let their right hand know what their left hand was doing, they endured the attacks in silence. Because they wanted to share with God's people who were in need. Paul says, "Practice hospitality." The word translated "practice" seems to have a greater force or power than just our English word "practice." It literally means run swiftly after in order to capture. The idea there is to pursue with diligence hospitality. It's probably had a greater import back in the first century when travelers and particularly itinerant preachers were quite dependent on the hospitality of other church members for their housing. But this is still a Christian virtue even today. It means being a lover of strangers, taking them in. So God is calling us to open our homes to those in need, but also to one another. We would do well to fellowship together often in one another's homes. Well, this is Paul's description of a sincere love. And if you're anything like me, you can see some pretty significant deficiencies in your practice of it. But this love is based on a sure and firm foundation. This sincere love to which we are called is based on the most sincere love imaginable. Matter of fact, it is so great and so powerful, it is beyond our imagination. It involves God's inscrutable gift to us, His Son. So our love springs from God's love for us. So let us exercise love toward one another as an expression of the love that we've already received from God. We love because He first loved us, John says in his first epistle. We would have no experience of love at all were it not for God having first loved us. The amazing thing is, He loves us in our unloveliness. We're no benefit to Him, but He loves us sincerely, even when He's doling out to us all the time and gaining nothing in return. Because of His love for us, He sent His Son to the cross. There was no other way for God to shower His love on us other than our sin being removed and Christ's righteous merit being placed into our account. It's the only way that He could do it. So in that way, having loved us to the uttermost, God now calls for a sincere love for one another. So let us show the love of Christ because He first loved us. He died for our hate and bias and prejudice. He shed His blood for our selfishness and self-honor and impatience and greed. He went to the cross for our lukewarmness. Herein is love. Not that we love God, but that He first loved us. Let us live in that love.